I have nothing to talk about this week.
That's because you've been quarantined in New Jersey.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let you all come over because you had the first case of corona. Did you see that? Pretty cool, right? Getting this started right there.
Cool, man.
A little Mirage UI for our training, which hopefully will morph into some stuff for the Mirage website. Pulled in a Tailwind UI sidebar layout component. So I just pasted that in.
Oh.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
I was going to say, that looks really nice. Yeah, for
because I didn't do it.
I was not going to say for you. I was going to say for something that you created like 15 minutes
ago.
Yeah,
exactly. I appreciate
but also that. For you.
Appreciate that, bud. You know, the thing with the Tailwind UI so far that I've found is, you know what's bothering me? Your OCD is rubbing off on me right now. Nice. You have a thing right here, but it's not actually being used. The Tailwind UI components, like they're either too big or too small right now. So I feel like I see them move in a direction where they're more like smaller level and composable. And maybe the answer there is like ultimately a React library. But like, I want a sidebar component, but I don't want the mobile menu, or I don't want the avatar thing at the bottom. So I kind of paste it in and I have to like find that stuff. And it's like duplicated because it's like a mobile and a desktop nav. So it's like you end up doing some work, and sometimes I'm like, this was like one of those borderline cases where it was really minimal for the training. And so I really didn't want to be spending any more time than absolutely necessary on the layout. And so I was like, oh, should I have just done it myself? But I think it's pretty cool.
It is cool that you can copy it and just delete the pieces totally. You don't want.
It's always like every time I've done it, I'm like, I don't really want to understand this. But then like once I'm like, I kind of have to figure out which classes to toggle and things like that. And then it always ends up being a little bit simpler than I thought. But I really do want just like even simple. I want like a React component or an Ember component or something.
It's so funny because when I think about Tailwind UI, I get really excited because for someone like me, it's like I get to see how Adam and Steve build stuff.
Yeah, I think actually the most value or the most excited I would get about it is if like we were working on something that we were doing that was like the design and the polish was like almost number one. And maybe I would like bring things in from Tailwind UI, but maybe not even. Maybe I would just use it as a reference and grab parts of it and see how he built certain things for exactly that reason. I've already actually done that because again, like the actual pre-built components, I'm always going to want to tweak them in a lot of ways, which is good because they're tweakable, but it's like, just seeing how he does the spacing and everything like that. It's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a natural conclusion here where there's like many, many smaller bits, and which makes that value add part of it even better, where you just like, show me how you do pills. Show me how you do this little bit of layout, and then I can learn and copy from there, as opposed to like inferring that from a massive, like a bigger
nav bar or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, we've been busy recently. We've been pretty busy on a bunch of different things. We have some consulting work going on. We have trainings that are coming up that we're doing next week. We're going to be in Portland. I guess when this comes out, we'll have already done the trainings.
Yep.
We're doing one on data modeling with Mirage, and definitely want some of this UI work and also some of our kind of how to think about relationships across the wire, getting from a back end to a front end to end up in the Mirage doc somewhere. And we're also doing a Tailwind training, which we're going to be repeating back here in New York as well. So both things that we love working with. So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see how those goes, and maybe we can talk about how those went afterwards. In the meantime, I've just been writing down some things because I've been building this consulting project. It's a React project. So kind of been learning some new stuff. And then also I've just been listening. There was a great series of podcasts in the last few weeks from, there might have been a React conference, but they were on Software Engineering Daily, and just some really interesting stuff.
Cool.
So yeah, that's kind of some of the things I have written down. First, let's talk about this LogX one. This is maybe a deeper one to jump right into, but I just want to because I just saw it and it sparked my memory. So I went to a Svelte meetup, which we've both been enjoying going to. You didn't make this last one, but we've been enjoying going to it, even though I think neither of us have ever written any.
When I'm in those meetups, I pull up the Svelte REPL and I start writing just so I can like kind of try to follow along. But yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool and we really like the people there. And there's like some good overlap. Side note, I don't want to get into all this right now. Maybe this is a future thing, but this is like a side note of a side note. I think it's really important for like tools to be working and thinking about working across like frameworks these days, because otherwise, you know, whether it's a data management library or a build tool or whatever it is, I think it's just so easy to want to build it to work for your specific tech stack. But like, there's just so much now, and it feels like the things with the longevity are going to be the things that are not dedicated within a single ecosystem. So like,
are you talking like Ember CLI versus Webpack here?
Yeah. That's one example. Yeah.
I agree with you, but also I think building the general thing is way harder.
Well, that's why you have to do less, I think.
Yes.
Okay. I'm trying to think of
talked about this before. Yeah, I mean, yes.
Yeah. Like look at what a lot of the modern stacks end up using. They end up using the general purpose thing. I was listening to this podcast about Meteor, and it was like a similar kind of, it was making a similar point that Meteor tried to do too much and take over too much, and inevitably it damaged its longevity. You know, mm-hmm. Whereas like a thing like Rollup or, even Tailwind, Tailwind operates outside the boundaries of any particular framework, can be used kind of everywhere, or, you know, a lot of the JavaScript libraries that are, look at like that project that just came out called, from Tom Preston Warner, right?
Redwood.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, they actually ended up making their own router, even though React Router existed, but that's more of a...
Can you feel me? I know nothing
about this. It's just like a combination of many tools in an opinionated way, but it's like...
But is it? It's still like JSX and...
Yeah, it's React.
Okay.
But then it's a bunch of other stuff. Anyways, I don't really want to get into super... This wasn't even the point I wanted to make. It's just been something that's been on my mind.
Welcome to the Ember Map podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It's just been something that's on my mind that's like, longevity is important, and I don't like to see wasted effort. And like, you know, even with like add-on docs, which is a project I've put a lot of time into, several of us have, and now we don't really have... It's not something we're working on anymore, and like... there's a longevity problem there, and it would be better spent thinking about how to use a tool. Like there's tools like Storybook and DocuSaurus, which are not tied to specific like frameworks. And it's just, especially for, again, we have talked about this before, especially for me a couple of years ago, going ahead first in the Ember community, it was always very tempting to want to make like the Ember solution. But now I just feel a little bit differently about things.
Yeah, I will say like...
Not that I don't think Ember solution is important. It's just like, it's just the sustainability stuff and the resources and everything.
Yeah. One thing just to like kind of counter this, I do like the fact that rather than trying to build a general solution to server mocking or to add-on docs, you target a very specific small community, and then you know if you can make something successful there, it's going to be easier to bring it out to the wider ecosystem.
Yes.
So I think add-on docs, you get a ton of valuable feedback
right
at a high level. And then like add-on docs was successful, and if it's something you want to continue, you kind of have like a
blueprint for making it general.
Yes. And I think that's a lot better than saying, I'm going to go off and I'm going to make a doc thing that works everywhere.
But see, maybe it would have been better to take off a certain part of the problem and make some and figure out how to make it work so that the work wasn't like just contained and constrained to the Ember ecosystem, or make something that integrated with the rest. Yeah, it's tough to know. You did learn a lot. You do learn a ton by making something specific to your pain point. Also, I was like solving my own pain point.
I mean, that's like scratching itch. Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, and all the work I've done that's been valuable has done that. I guess it's just like there's a point at which you have to talk about face the music, right? And it's like,
I mean, absolutely. If Ember ecosystem and if is not going to sustain your work,
right,
you should absolutely
right.
But think that, about. I just want to say, like, I don't think you wasted effort.
Yeah,
bringing these things to Ember.
But I think there can be better. Definitely don't think it was not wasted effort. It's more about the opportunity cost and the alternatives, which is like, instead of continuing to forge down that road, you know what I'm saying? there is a point at which it makes sense to talk about what are other communities solving similar problems using, and how can we integrate with those things so that we're not duplicating work and you know, all this stuff.
Yeah, I think that if you were going to continue working on add-on docs, I would definitely have that comment.
Yeah.
But I also think that if you were going to build add-on docs from scratch.
Yeah. It makes sense to focus on one use case.
Can you get every Ember developer using it? Because that's...
Tells you something.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's an easier... You get to like target some high-level things, not because of Ember itself, just because everyone's using the same tool set.
I guess my thing is maybe the response to that is like, should you start by trying to get every Ember developer to use this thing, or should you start by trying to find everyone who's has the same pain point, maybe across frameworks and communities, in the same way that we could say like who's having a problem writing mocks for tests, and then you're thinking about it a little bit differently.
Probably want to find everyone that's having the same pain point, and then if you can like
market to them, that's a hard thing. Is like are you in touch with their needs in the same way that you're in touch with your community's needs?
Yeah, but if you notice that like there's a huge group of Create React app developers with this pain point, then maybe that lets you say, okay, I'm going to bite off this small community first. Because I'm sure Python developers have documentation problems.
Right.
But trying to build something for Python and React might be hard. So if you can, I think you'd want to find people that have the problem and then see if there's a way you can
share a solution. Yeah. I think the reason I started thinking about that is because this note here is about Logux. And it's like Logux is more like Orbit or Redux in the sense that it works with any JavaScript library as opposed to Ember Data or like Apollo, which I think is only for React. that was a long-winded way of saying at the Svelte meetup, where we don't practice Svelte and start thinking about cross-cut community concerns, the creator of Logux gave a talk, who also happens to be the creator of PostCSS. It was a pretty cool meetup evening. He was there, you know, Rich Harris, who created Svelte, and Rollup was there. Sean Wicks, who's like a good, well-known guy in the front-end ecosystem, was there, works at Netlify. Just impressive people, like, honestly, like, humbling to be in a room. Like, also, the Svelte meetup is pretty small, and it's like,
I was going to say, this reminds me of like early Ember.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's really cool. All really excited about what they're doing. So anyways, this guy who created Logux, he gave a talk on it. And you've used Logux, right? By the way, I think Logux is like a horrible name. I kind of want to tell him that once we become friends. Like, dude.
I have used it. I have no comments on the name.
Wait, come on. But, how do you even say it? Say it.
Logux. I guess you're... Well, I've never really said it.
Yeah, that's the problem. It also sounds like Redux, which apparently people hate right now, so no good. Logux. 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 he gave a talk on this, and you did use it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I built a little app with it.
It's really, really cool. And I think really the main point I wanted to make here, Sitnik, the developer, his first name is not Sitnik, but that's what...
Andre?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Audrey? Something like that.
Yeah. Alexi, something like that. We're just being Andre. Terribly offensive over here. Making up names that start with A. The reason...
I was right.
Yeah, you were.
Okay,
I thought you said Alexis or something. Alexi.
Go ahead.
Just digging this deeper and deeper. Lots of really interesting things about this project. Some of it reminded me of Orbit, and we've had this conversation on the podcast before, but, it's like it embraces this idea of like log-based, data. One really cool point he made. So just for listeners who are not familiar with Logux, it is a framework agnostic data layer that has both a client and a server layer. And, it is responsible for transport. And his presentation broke it down really nice, where we have good conventions on the front end, good conventions on the back end, but this is still like the Wild West. And I was like, you're preaching. I'm like,
yeah.
My ears peaked up, you know, my skin on the back of my neck starts tingling. I'm getting excited because you're speaking my language, brother. And he was basically saying, like, you can build a conventional Rails API, like, and it's going to be super solid. And like, people are really comfortable with using you know, Redux on the front end, or, you know, Ember Data App. Like, there are answers there. It's just like, how do these things work together? So his whole thing is that you have your adapter, your Ember Data or your Redux calls go through the client piece, and then they turn things into something, and then you put something in front of your server that knows how to like read those. And the way the data is going over is like logs and like transactions, which again is kind of like an ORBIT style thing, as opposed to what we're normally used to doing with REST, which is like the state of the thing and like state transfer. Mm-hmm. So instead of state transfer, you're like sending operations back and forth. So if we had the title of an Ember map video and we said like how to animate Ember, and then you hit save, it would say that over. And then, you know, or like, let's say a bank balance, or like a number of attendees, and you from your computer put 30 and you hit enter, normal REST would just send it over with like number of attendees :30. And then I'd change it to like 32, and it would just be number of attendees 32. And then you change it back to 30, and it's 30. And so every time you're basically like writing that data. And so at the end of the day, in your backend, whatever you're storing, the data has like 30. And you didn't know it was at 1.32. Whereas with this system, or with these log-based systems in general, you're storing like 30, set to 30, and like increment by 2, and then like decrement by 2. So mm-hmm. It's more like saving a log, like a banking statement with a list of transactions. And of course, you can get the balance by rolling those up. But you always have those logs. And sometimes we talk about that as storing the facts. What's really cool when you start thinking about this is if you store every fact ever that happens in your system, you're never going to be in a situation where you might be like, all right, your product manager is like, we want to implement revision history for this article. And it's like, okay, we can start doing that now, but we don't have the history up until this point. If you store the facts, you will never be in a situation where you cannot implement any feature because of lack of data, because you've literally stored all the facts that are relevant, really. Yeah. You know, hand wavy there, but that's the basic idea. Cool. It also lets you do like undo and redo and things like that.
Well, that's one thing I was going to add, is that's using it. That was one of the things that really impressed me, was that, like revision history is like, it's like a feature. And if I'm not building a CMS, do I really care about this? But there's a lot of stuff like undo, optimistic updates with undo.
There's a lot of really cool things that just fall out of this model for doing things. You have like disconnected clients. So basically, because it's all operations, if you're like offline, you also have offline. You're basically... storing all of these, and as soon as you get back online, you just flush the transaction list over the network. You can do that from like a multi-client architecture, and you can also gives you an opportunity to figure out how to resolve conflicts because you have this. If you think about it, like just saving the state every time makes it difficult to resolve the conflicts because you've lost the facts of what happened, and so you can't ascertain the intentions from each user. Whereas when you have logs, there's some conflict resolution algorithms that just like work out of the box for you. And you can also like customize them based on your business logic. But basically this becomes like a much simpler thing. And you can really think about it like Git, in the same way that every person using Git on their computer can be offline and start making commits. I mean, every commit is basically an operation, it's basically a log. And when you go to push, the central server can have all this logic about how it makes sense to resolve conflicting logs. And if it can do it automatically, it works without you doing anything. So like the clients never even know. And then they can pull, you know, and they can get all the latest logs. And so, I was just talking about all this with everyone, and it's like, we've been here before, and it's like, whatever we're talking about this, we always get to like this kind of thing. We get to Git. And then of course is how MySQL replicates itself as well. So if you set up a database with like master slaves, under the hood, it's just a bin log, which is like a list of operations. And the master can be here. The slaves can be offline. And when they come back online, they essentially do a Git pull and they replay the operations. It's like an immutable log of operations on top of their local copy of the data.
Yeah. And one thing about the MySQL replication is they don't need to like reject. Right, they're just following a leader database. They don't need to say,
they don't have the opportunity to write.
Yeah. With
So it'd be like git pull only, and you never have conflicts.
Right. With logux, when you're talking about going offline, coming online, flushing all the facts, and then maybe resolving a rejected commit. One thing I love about the framework is that, that what you're describing there is the library. So you're just writing, like, and from your code's point of view, everything is like an optimistic update. Everything is optimistic update. Now you can, you get an API to await, like await until the server confirms the write. But I think that makes API development a lot easier. That was one of the things I noticed. The other thing is, like, there's also an API for undo. Like, there's like a literal API for undo. So it's not like you have to wire up the code for rejection. You can imagine that, like, I have a Redux store that I send actions to. And then if I ever get an undo, well, I just roll back my Redux store to that exact action. I have a list of future actions that have been rolled back, and I can basically present the user with something to resolve it. But, like,
your app state is going to be in a valid state because you're just rolling back to that Redux point. So that's kind of, that was,
Now, you know, sometimes you might not be able to resolve this. It might be something like,
you tried to send it and, like, we had removed him from the system.
Exactly.
Something you just undo it. And
so it's not always as easy as, like, the point you just made, like, your app is always in a valid state because you're in a state that you were in before.
Right.
Is still true.
Right.
But, it gets complicated. I think the point I'm trying to make here is, like, the library itself gives you, like, the hook to put the undo logic.
Yeah.
So you're not, like, that's always the hardest part. It's like a global hook,
and you're not, like, having to, like, write it coupled to any particular part of the UI.
Yeah. Yep. And I know there is a, like, Redux logux implementation that, like, literally does all that, roll back to this action
where that the thing that happened that was, like, rejected by the server. That's so he mentioned that. I didn't realize it was, like, an actual library, but the way he mentioned it, which really basically just, like, said what you were saying, and it made a light bulb go off for me, which was, like, if you have those, like, 11 actions and it's rejected, you can literally just undo them in Redux, and, like, you don't need a UI for that. It's just, it's going to happen automatically. So that just, like, falls out of this architecture. It's something you get for free by, like, building within these constraints, which is, like, extremely powerful. Something else he talked about. Go ahead.
No. Do all the pauses because I want to talk about actually building an app.
So the other thing was really cool. So anyways, that starts to get you thinking about – like, how the data layer actually might be a separate responsibility from a lot of the components in your UI, where – normally you think about, if I'm going to build an undo button, you're going to, like, auto save, and then you edit, and then, like, within that component or within that route action in Ember or whatever, you're, like, saving. You're, like, you have, it's a logical place. And, like, David Korshaw talks about this on Twitter sometimes about how all UIs are, like, event driven. But this kind of starts to make you think about it, where, like, instead of having the data layer kind of coupled and, like, kind of spread throughout, like, your UI tree, there's a lot of really nice things that come from having it almost as, it's a separate layer that can be abstracted that you don't even have to think about. Think about if you try to do undo and stuff. Think about if you save a model, you know, we're used to doing, like, dot catch, model dot errors, model dot rollback. But to think that that's a completely, even if you want a UI a certain way, to think that that logic is a separate domain, like a thing that can be abstracted away from your UI code, is kind of remarkable. And then there's another part of this, which he mentioned, which was, like, the error handling. So the idea being, what if error handling was, like, a global thing? So like, how many actions in the last UI that we built don't have an error state, whether it's, like, a field on a form or clicking a save button or a loading thing taking too long? He said it in a really interesting way. I can't quite remember it right now, but the idea was being, like, what if all your logic is in this constrained layer, then, like, you can have global errors where they, like, pop up and show you what's happened to your data, but it's almost independent of the particular UI. It's made me think of more of, like, a native app. And it's like, you're like, of course, you can display contextual errors, but the idea is more like how much more robust would that feel if any error from the server or in a mutation is going through the single store and is linked to like a global UI.
Yeah, yeah, this is
that. How much of a better starting point is that for building an app?
Right, rather than save handler that has a dot catch that, okay, now I set some component state.
Exactly, yeah. And you're not doing that. You're really maybe not even calling save anymore. You're like sending a message to this thing or whatever. Or you're calling save, but it's just doing that. Basically, conceptually, you're like pulling this layer out of your UI trees. Like, pretty interesting.
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind there is kind of like it's like error state by default rather than what we have now, which is just basically uncaptured state by default.
Right. Silent errors. Yeah. So what's it like actually building it?
So it's super fun. So I'll just get that out of the way. Like everything we just talked about, you actually, you know, it's really fun. Like sending a message to your to like your reducer, to sending a message to somewhere, and that message puts it in your reducer as well as sending it off to logux and seeing that thing show up on the server. It's pretty cool, especially when you have two clients, like you open up like Firefox and Chrome and you have two clients and you just know that like, yeah, you're generating an action for your reducer in Chrome and that same action by way of logux ends up in Firefox because the server just acts as a middleman. It accepts a thing and then gives the same log to Firefox and Firefox then sends that log into the reducer. And so
that's crazy,
right? Because like when we think about like models, we're like, oh, you do a save over here, then there's like a WebSocket event that like gets new data, and then I like find the model, I update. But you think of it as like two different sides.
Yep.
But this is just like the same message, the same action.
It's literally like a MySQL slave.
Yeah, that ends up in both places.
That's just pulling the newest version of the log or whatever.
So that was really cool, and it's fun. The biggest the bummer with this, and like the reason I didn't continue using it, is you actually don't have a list of logs. You do on the client as you're generating events on the client, but when you go to save data to the server, and this of course depends on like your database setup and everything, but in my app, I'm writing it to a Postgres database.
Yeah.
Most people are doing something similar.
So like you have a traditional Rails server, let's say, and his little, I think I asked him and he said he has a server piece that can like turn those messages into like normal calls to like Postgres or whatever.
I used his server. Gotcha. So he's got a node.
Yep. Okay.
But what happens is I get that action on the server and the server then does something to its Redux store, right? But like, if you think about it, what is the server's Redux store? It's a like Postgres Postgres database.
And you're not like saving a log of transactions to a transactions table and then having things materialize or whatever.
So this is
do that.
Yeah, of course you could. But that's like, that's a bigger architecture change.
Yeah, yeah.
So also too, we'll get into why that might be problematic. So now if you have two clients connected and one client's making changes and the other client's making changes, it's awesome because they all have each other's logs and everything. And then you have a third client connect, let's say like 30 minutes later, the third client is not going to get a list of logs. It's basically going to get the state from the database.
Because they're ephemeral since they're not being saved. The state is being saved.
Right. Yeah. And so there's a lot of reasons for this. And I think they outline it in the docs, but like basically, the big reason is like sending new clients a list of all the logs is
not scalable.
It's like might take a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a toy app, you know, honestly, in like the toy apps that even like a client app I worked on last year, like it might actually be doable because their clients are connecting every day and there's not, I mean, there might be a couple thousand events that happen, but that's not that many.
Right.
But that was kind of a bummer, right? So like, if you're imagining like kind of like a roll forward, roll back thing, and you have two clients that have everything and then a third that just has like the materialized state. Now, if the third client gets commands like update this user, well, he's going to know exactly what to do because he's got that user. But if he gets something like roll back this action, he's not going to have that action. Mm. He's not going to be able to roll back. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that kind of confused me.
Mm-hmm.
just how to think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. Yeah.
He did talk about that because I was like, I kind of talked to him afterwards and I was like, does that mean the back end needs to store all the logs? And he was like, there is some talk he had about why you don't, like, I think he called it state-based something.
Yeah, he's got a whole, I think he's got a bunch, when I looked at it, there were like a bunch of markdown files and he has like a whole section dedicated to this.
And how that can be a good solution. So I'm sure it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's answers to that. Basically the question you just brought up, which is like, the whole point is like, if you play by these rules, you get all these cool things. But as soon as you are like talking about a client that connects with like a materialized view and derived state, it's like, you're not playing by the rules anymore. Right. So like, you don't get all the stuff.
Yeah. Now you could,
or at
make
least
it,
you get it down a little, you don't get it as well or something.
There might be some architecture decisions that like, if you are going to roll back a commit, the server can decide like, what is the opposite of this commit? So instead of
like a down and up migration.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. That's a similar thing, right? Migrations are kind of like logs on changes to the database, and like the database is like a,
yeah.
So, but you still need to store those somewhere.
You do not, when I built it, they were very clear that like, you do not store the logs
in the back end.
Yeah. So that was,
interesting.
Yeah. There were some other parts of the app. Like the parts about data was awesome. Just being able to like optimistic update. First of all, you feel like you don't have a back end.
Yeah.
Because you're just optimistic updating, and then like asynchronously those logs are syncing.
Yeah.
So think about writing a front end without having a back end. Just how easy would that be? How much easier would that be?
Yeah, it'd be like working against Mirage app, basically.
Yeah, but
it's like fast.
Not only that.
I mean, it's like, fast to develop. It's fast to build.
Yeah, but
oh, like, you're just saying if you could just call like local storage.save or everywhere.
Not even that. Just think if you could just say like, you could send an action to a store that adds a new user.
Yeah.
And that's it. The user shows up on the page.
Yeah,
there's zero latency.
Yeah,
there's,
yeah.
It's just,
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. So that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool feeling.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm definitely gonna keep my eye on this. I'm really happy. If this sounds interesting, like I took like 6 hours to build like a little app, that was like, track the books I read, and it was super fun.
Yeah. That's cool. That's very cool. The website's really great too. He did a great job on it.
Yeah.
He wrote a whole blog post.
That was not available when I started this.
Oh, I was going to say, because I don't remember it looking like this and being as well organized and everything, but I think
there's
a bunch
of markdown files.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think he's been investing in it a lot. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yep.
So that was really cool. There was another error thing related to errors. So anyways, I thought the global error handling thing was really neat because I think it's just I've never thought about that before.
Yeah, because when you call save, you don't have a central place where everything's funneling.
Yeah, exactly. Just very interesting.
Or like fetch with post.
Yeah, yeah.
No central place.
Right. There's another thing related to errors. Another podcast I listened to was Guillermo talking on Software Engineering Daily about everything that Guillermo talks about, which is like always the same stuff. He just gets super jacked up about like performance and deploys and stuff.
Nice.
You know, they're getting closer. They're getting close to his like ideal architecture. They've been iterating on like his recommendations recently. And I think a new version of Next just came out. And I know last time we were talking a couple weeks ago, we went on this big deep dive about Next, even though we didn't really know it. So like, we really need to try it out, because I think the newest release actually addressed a lot of the stuff we were talking about.
Cool.
Where it's like, you can choose what to do on the server and what to do on the client, and you can basically, it all came back to like, can you, one way he said it, I think in the podcast, he's like, if this thing that I requested, it can't, is not being served from a CDN, and it can be, it seems like a waste to me. It's like, why is it like that? So the question is, of course, like, what can be served from a CDN? And that in our last conversation, we were talking a lot about how recent the data needs to be. And if it's too recent, if the recency needs are too high, you can't tolerate stale data, then like, you can't just push it out to a CDN and invalidate that all the time, right? Like that's where having a server-side runtime server-side call makes sense to, like, let's say go to a central database. Remember we were talking about like the temperature in this room and you had to get it.
Yeah. Not even runtime server-side call, just not running code at the edge.
Yeah. Yes. So, he made this interesting point that it's also, it simplifies other things too, where, so the solution there is like, then we went into this conversation about like, does it ever make sense to have like your server, even if your server is running on the edge, to like have your servers go back to a central database and then hand it off to the client, or just let the clients request? And so in this episode, he talks a lot about how he's like moving away from that and like just having the clients request everything. So like, what can be CDNified, if it's not the whole page, it's as much of it as you can, like the JavaScript and HTML and CSS, like the app shell. But then like, if we were building a Rails app that we were going to like distribute around the world and like whatever, like the server would be fetching, let's say for chat, let's say for Slack, right? The server would be like fetching those and sending them up. But like, he made this point that like, instead, just like CDN the shell and then let the client fetch everything, because like we have JavaScript that we can, and it also simplifies it, right? And that's kind of, that's like a conclusion we came to. But it wasn't just about the recency. He made some really interesting points about security too, and error handling. And it was a really interesting way he put it. I wanted to reread it before we got on the mics, but he was just saying, think about it. Like, think about you're making something like Slack or WhatsApp. Like, you're already running your app in a sandbox environment in a browser on the client's machine. And so now you can just fetch data from, like, I don't know if it was from origin. Basically from origin. Like, you don't, you could have a proxy server for sure, but you don't have the logic running right there. You go straight from the client to like origin, let's just say, for simplicity. And so now you just have it, like, simplifies a lot of things, because like, how many times have we had to do error handling in like two environments? I mean, I guess the backend needs to validate certain things that only the backend can validate, but it's more like that. There's like, if you can ship as much as you can ship to the edge, to edge servers, and leave the data stuff that is sensitive to privacy and security for the client, your edge server architecture stays super simple. I think that's what his point was.
When you say like, I'm not really tracking. So when you say like security stuff, are you saying that the security is now a question between client and origin?
Yes. Okay. And like, think about like, even with Fastboot, I think I was making this connection with like Fastboot, because Fastboot introduces like security issues, because like you're caching things that could be like,
not even cached, like
not even cached.
You
just, right.
You are running
shared environment.
Yeah,
that was it. Because it's not like a shared environment anymore. Basically, it was this point about the data that is like private to the user. If you're running it on the user's machine, like, you don't have, like, there's just a whole class of security problems and errors you don't have to deal with it anymore.
I mean, absolutely. The introduction of server-side rendering introduces things that we never even considered.
Can you explain, can you elaborate, like, what you're thinking there?
Yeah, so, like, let's just say I'm running a React app, and I'm running a login form, and I do, like, you know, I have two set states, email and password. I'm storing your password in plain text as you type in that input.
Yeah.
Do I care? It's like, no, like, no one else in the world can see that. That's running on your computer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And we know that, like, okay, maybe there is a, I don't know, a browser memory link with leak with like performance.measure, and other tabs can view data from your tab. Maybe that could happen.
Right. Right.
But, that's something, that's not something I need to worry about. That's a Chrome thing, and Chrome's pretty good at security.
Right. Browser's already a sandbox environment.
Right. So they can just remove those performance APIs when this happens, hypothetically. Okay, but now I'm running in Fastboot, or I'm running on the server.
Yeah.
And any state I set.
Yeah.
So, like, any state I set is, okay, it's on the server. It's in that instance. So like the whole idea is like I get a new request. I spin up a new server-side rendering app. You don't really set state on the server because set state's responding to an event handler, mm-hmm. but maybe like you read some request headers and write them to some POJO. Mm-hmm. Like you read like a encrypted session or signed session and you store that somewhere to reuse it. But the idea is like you spin up a new instance of your app, request comes in, you write some data that's on your server memory. Mm-hmm. You generate the HTML, you ship that back to the client.
And another request comes in.
And another request. Well, now you tear down your app.
Yeah.
Because that app has state in it.
Yeah.
That was specific to that first request.
Yeah.
So you tear down your app.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's like your server's kind of slow. Like, how could we improve the performance of this server? Like, mm-hmm. well, what if we didn't have to tear down the app?
Mm-hmm.
What if we could just like, there was a lot of like initialization code for the app that has nothing to do with like the rendering. So what if we could just run, like spin up an instance of that app, and then start sending requests to it, and we have a clear place to put initialization code
mm-hmm.
that is like per the client, mm-hmm. so things like current user and mm-hmm. so on, and then per like the application itself.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe like, mm-hmm. I don't know, you're logging the time the app booted up or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are questions that happen when you run code on the server.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you've moved from a sandboxed environment that will not leak data,
right.
which is a user's browser, to right. An environment that's sharing memory
right.
for all your users.
Right.
And so if you like happen to be using the same instance of your app and you store user data in that app, it could leak.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, just...
It's like death by a thousand cuts.
Surprisingly easy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even knowing all this, like we have places and had... I mean, we do a good job of... We actually like strip out all that info before it goes to Fastweek.
But we had to do that ourselves.
We had to do that.
And understand it.
We had to get to a point where... Yeah, exactly. Where, oh, shit.
Yeah.
This data could end up in Fastweek.
Right.
So.
Right. Interesting. Now, what I'm still a little confused about is like, ultimately, there is an origin server. Let's just say like there's origin and then there's like N... like of these like servers that are closer to the edge where the app shell is being delivered. If each client in the browser has to go to origin to get the messages, like the origin server still needs this lot, like still needs to handle requests from like multiple clients. And depending on how that's architected there, that origin server could still have this like risk of like shared memory, of course.
Right, but you're not at that point.
But I guess the reason...
No, the point is that the app has already been rendered at that point.
Okay.
So you're just fetching data, right? Okay. Because it's like the rendered app is fetching data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The rendered app on the client's machine is fetching data.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like it's going to like an API server. It's not it's not asking Origin to like render a React component.
Right.
At least I think. That's...
No, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So the request is coming in from like a sandbox environment instead of
it's an Ajax request instead of an HTML request.
Yes, I got that. I just didn't understand right because the request itself is coming from a sandboxed environment that is trustworthy.
Yes.
That's more trustworthy than a shared place.
And think of the servers that serve API responses.
Mm-hmm.
Those things we've been building those things for the last 25 years that literally isolate every request.
Right.
Just because it makes it super easy to code web servers when you have a controller we talked about this on a previous episode, but exactly when you have a controller that just thinks it has, it doesn't share memory amongst requests.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So by design, we've been building these servers for so long that we literally don't even think about this.
Right.
So,
there are bugs you can have with the API server that come from shared state in the sense of like leaking like database info that belongs to someone else. But that is there's a boundary around those class of problems.
Right, right.
What this eliminates is another class of problems where like requests are basically compromised by being made from like servers instead of by sandbox client environments.
Exactly. And you can
that makes sense.
You can leak requests. You have to go pretty out of your way in a Rails app to do that.
Yep.
You can do it.
Yep.
You know.
Yep. You wouldn't put it past me.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. And then also he was making this point about like simplifying like the error logic, like the error handling logic from like the UI and client side, where it's just like, yeah, I guess it's probably just like fewer things that can go wrong because like the client is the one making the request. It knows more about it. Problems that happen, you know, from it. So yeah, it would be interesting to go back and read that through. Yeah, he, you know, basically like this next, the new release of Next, I really want to see. They all should have listened to our podcast with, they all should have listened to Mike Perham and named their things with a misspelling or something other. So when we talk about Next and logs and Logix, I guess, yeah, is pretty Logix good.
Is great. It's
a pretty weird name that you can Google, but Next is hard to talk about. We should go try the new release because it can like output. I think it automatically outputs like a standard SSG server-side generated bundle if it, your app isn't making any requests. This was the other thing, right? So one of the things we were hung up on in that conversation is like, okay, great. They give us get initial props, but like that's not how I write a React app. So what is the path from going to like a slow to a fast app? And it was like, when I'm writing a React app in Next, I am using like use effect to do data fetching. And then there's like your dashboard is slow. So like, let's switch it over to like get initial props. And it can be like requested and cached there instead of having to wait to be rendered on the client to like fetch it or whatever. And so that's the path there. And it was like, we wanted something that was like, oh, the Ember model is interesting because you're always, you don't change your application architecture. Like model is the choke point for the route. And then you can decide on the server, you know, to fast boot a certain route or whatever. And then he was saying like the use effect thing is actually good because of this reason, because, you know, basically, like if your client app is fetching data, you want it to be done on the client.
And use effect.
And use effect
makes that very clear.
Yeah, exactly. Because it doesn't happen until it renders. So you're already in the user's browser.
Okay.
And so every other situation, basically going back to his point about like...
Can I just remind to what you just said about... It sounds like it's actually a good thing that you have to change your application architecture because these are decisions that you need to make.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's what he was saying. And he was talking about how like the developers know the most about this with the different parts of their app, whether this is a marketing page that I can like server generate and is like not subject to privacy concerns, or whether this is like chat data that needs to be run in a privileged environment like the user sandbox. So
I mean, that's a great, I'm just thinking of our settings page versus our homepage.
That's exactly what I thought when he was saying it. And it's like, you don't even want to think about basically how to cache this and do it. You just want to do it on the client because it's like the overriding concern here is like it's a privileged thing. So for that, you ship the shell. But for the homepage and all of our other pages based on Ember Map, you want to like generate them.
You know, that's the use effect thing is really good because if we did do the setting calls in use effect type architecture, type way of thinking, like, oh, we have to isolate these in use effect, then we don't get into what I was saying earlier where it's like, oh, we actually strip out all sensitive request headers.
Yeah.
Before they go into our fastboot app because we don't want like a signed cookie to be accidentally stored anywhere in fastboot. So we literally strip that stuff out before it goes in, which is a lot easier to get wrong than just make setting calls and use effect.
Right. Pretty interesting, right? Yeah. Also, like the fact that our homepage and our settings page, you both use the model hook. And now when you flip fastboot on, both are going to be running server side. But maybe it doesn't make sense. You want to run settings on the client side. So now you have to re-architect that and pull the data fetch out of the model hook and put it into something like use effect, did insert elements that only runs on the client.
Was this what we're talking about here? Was this his point about security?
Yes.
Okay. This is
related to it all. Yeah.
Okay.
And so he was saying, let's say if you want to make the homepage like generated, also I think it like infers things. Basically, if your query is like, there's APIs for, again, I'm like not super prepared because we've just been busy for this discussion, but there's the new APIs that they added to Next that are like, this is either like a static query or it's like a dynamic query that needs to wait until, so one can be run ahead of time at build time.
Oh, so it can be a build time thing. So yes. It's just the data structure at runtime.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Wow. And that's in the framework.
Yep.
And you can do that at the query level?
Yep.
Okay. That's pretty freaking cool.
I think.
I mean, we could.
At least the page level, but definitely. Yeah. There's.
Yeah. At least the page level. Sure.
Yes. Yes. No, it's really. So this
I'm trying to think.
It's a hybrid. He calls it a hybrid app. It's like hybrid apps. Like your marketing page is public, cacheable, should be served by the CDN. Going back to this thing, can this be served by a CDN? If so, yes, it should be easy. The tool should make it very easy to do so. And you have the same app with the marketing page and now your settings page, which is sensitive and you'd want to deliver the app shell. What of the settings page can you deliver on the CDN, the shell? And then you wait until the user's browser makes the sensitive request, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome episode. It's like super interesting stuff.
I really like that there's like a first class way to differentiate between build time and runtime.
Yes.
That's like right up my alley.
Totally. Static generation or server-side rendering. Automatic static optimization. When a page does not have blocking data fetching requirements like get initial props, it will be automatically rendered to HTML at build time.
Ah, because even if my page uses useEffect,
there are more cases.
Still pre-render it.
Exactly.
That's a client-side concern, not a server-side concern.
There are cases where you might want to render a page to static HTML at build time, even with blocking data fetching requirements. Example of this is marketing pages powered by a CMS. So this would be like MMS homepage.
And what would be that? That would be like get initial props.
Well, get initial props is like basically deprecated now, I think. So it's called get static props.
But the Embermaps homepage wouldn't be static.
At build time.
Wouldn't be static props.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't because we want to be able to publish to the CMS and do it again.
Yeah.
Maybe like.
We wouldn't want to use effect because we do want the code to run on the server.
Right. So I think this is going to be get server side props. So get initial props is basically
get server side props. That's a pretty good. Go ahead.
Yeah, get initial props. Get static props. Would be like
reading markdown files.
Exactly.
Or something.
Something that you are okay with that build time and not being updated until the next build. So that would be like Mirage.js. Mirage.js doesn't make any API calls that need to be happening at runtime.
I have a question inside.
But if we wanted to make a GraphQL request or something like that.
Inside get static props.
Yeah.
That's what's called.
Yeah.
Where does that run? Does that run in a node process during the build? And do you have like access to a lot of.
Yes.
So I could query a content mesh. Yeah.
Yes. Query content mesh. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Can you.
It's basically like the GraphQL stuff from Gatsby.
I think this thing is dynamic, but it only ever needs to run once, and so we can run it.
It gets turned into JavaScript data at build time, and it's never being run as a query on the client. You know,
I think it's really cool that this is acknowledging that you're building a site and you have both marketing pages and internal pages,
totally
private page, whatever we're going to call those. I think that's really cool because there's
super
always
cool.
Think about all the apps we've built. It's always like, oh, do we do this in Rails? How do we do this? Like our whole Ember map caching layer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's,
the fact that it's first class acknowledgement. We basically already do this, right?
The problem is we do it.
Yeah. Yeah. We do everything. Get static props always runs in Node. If you export an async function called get static props from a page, next we'll pre-render this page at build time. Always runs in Node, allows you to use any asynchronous or even synchronous data fetching technique, including fetch, REST, GraphQL, even directly accessing a database.
Pretty cool.
Really cool. When should I use it? If the data required to render the page is available at build time ahead of a user's request. Data comes from a headless CMS. I mean, that's not exactly true because you might want a headless CMS to be powering something that changes often enough that you don't want to be rebuilding
to be editable. Yeah.
It's really the first point. The data can be publicly cached, not user-specific. Page must be pre-rendered for SEO and be very fast. Get static props generates HTML and JSON files, both of which can be cached by CDN for performance.
You know, back to the headless CMS thing, everything is so integrated these days where there's like hooks to everything that if you think about it, you're doing like way more reads from a headless CMS.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you want all your clients making those reads than you are writes? Right, you're doing way more reads from a headless CMS.
Yeah.
So you could just hear me out. you could just use static props
and just rebuild the site
and just have like a hook that links your headless CMS service to your Netlify deploy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It sends a message. I mean, yeah, sure. We could do that with Emmermap.
Yeah.
So I change the title in our admin, and then I just wait like
25 minutes.
Well, would it take that long?
Gotta wait for our test to run.
No, this is all this is no, but this goes back to the recency issue and when we worked at yeah, TED too, yeah. Like and why people were confused how long things would take. Yep. It's like indeterministic sometimes. But
As a, you're right. As a
busting
default,
the cache of the CDNs.
As a default, you should read from headless CMS at runtime, I think. But
it depends too. How often does data change in Emmermap? Let's say it changes 4 or 5 times a week, like videos, edits, podcasts, you know.
Yep.
Let's say it's 5, even 10 times a week. What's the trade-off you're making? You wait 8 minutes for everything to finish or something, and then all the other times of the entire 24/7 week reads are like literally as fast as they possibly can be because it's just HTML at from a CDN.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good trade-off. And even maybe something like TED, it would make sense because you're having like millions of reads and now they're all CDNified. There's no runtime server involved for the vast majority of the pages until use effect kicks in and renders some user specific stuff. But yeah, that is the trade-off. So whereas, you know, obviously for Slack, you can't do that. It's recency. It's fresch.
Challenge accepted.
I could literally see that it was going on in your brain the way your eye twitched. We spend way too much time together. This is cool too, get static paths. I think this is a really nice little like helper thing, which is like, let's say you have a dynamic route, but you know all the things ahead of time, like API docs for Mirage. Now you can just give it a function that returns a static paths and it will crawl it.
And it will run.
And it'll run
like
build.
That page for every ID. Really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, we it's funny.
We built this.
We have this in Gatsby.
We do.
But we, it's not. It's
at
not,
the right level of expression.
Exactly.
It's not.
We're
as
creating pages.
As yes.
And yep.
Yeah.
They're in two very different files.
Yes.
You don't know how they're linked.
Exactly. Whereas this could be literally an API page.
And this
pages
function
slash
would,
API slash class.
And this function
it's
would go.
It's a dynamic
go,
class. So it would be like curly bracket. It would be called a curly bracket class. And then the function, if you export this function.
From like the file.
Yes.
From the page
from that,
file.
Yes. From the class file. The dynamic route. The named
cool.
Dynamic route. So you have like pages slash API slash bracket class
mm-hmm.
that tells next is like a dynamic route. And then if you export get static paths, then it will server side generate all of the pages for each slug.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Super cool. And then get server side props. If you export an async function called get server side props from a page, next, we'll render this page on each request, server-side rendering. Get server-side props always run server-side, and the code is automatically tree-shaken from browser bundles, ensuring that less code is sent to the browser. This way, you don't have to worry about the execution of data fetching code in both server and browser environments, which have some inconsistencies. This increases performance in many cases, as a server will generally have a faster connection to data source. It also increases security by exposing less of the data fetching logic. This allows you to use any asynchronous or even synchronous data fetching technique, including Fetch, REST, GraphQL, even directly access a database. When navigating between pages using nextlink, instead of executing get server-side props in the browser, next we'll do a fetch to the server, which will return the result of calling get server-side props. So I think get initial props runs in both contexts, and I think they've changed this basically to run only on the server.
On the server. You know, that's really interesting. What can you? There was a line where you said that this... If you run them both on the client and the server, there's inconsistencies. What was that line?
Get server-side props always run server-side, and the code is automatically tree-shaken from browser bundles, ensuring that less code is sent to the browser. This way, you don't have to worry about the execution of data fetching code in both server and browser environments, which have some inconsistencies.
So this is definitely something we ran into with Fastboot, where we would have to think about what how does this run on the server? How does this run on the client?
Like a domain and origin things and headers and forwarding and redirects and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. That's, yeah. I was thinking even like just like, again, like the settings page is always the easiest to go back to, but just like don't like literally there's a
library that doesn't work in Node that works in the browser.
Yeah. So you're wrapping code. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Inconsistencies.
Yeah. That's a really good one.
Yep. So the context parameter isn't up. Okay. So basically, that's interesting where like you go back to the server and then the server runs get server side props and then returns the result. So then if you want to make a request on the client, you use effect and you just do fetch.
Mm-hmm.
Or you do insert element with Ember and do a fetch. So you're never actually running like the same thing conceptually in both places. Yeah. You have like client side fetching, which is like the most sandboxed place, which is where you'd fetch your messages if you're doing like a chat app, let's say. What would you use get server side props for?
Well, I think when you're starting to do server side rendering, it might be nice to just make a database call,
yeah,
and get server side props and be able to just give your component, your page component, a bunch of props.
But then doesn't that mean that you can't?
Like in Fastboot, we can't do that because in Fastboot, our mental model is like, which I still am happy with the Fastboot model.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool.
But I'm saying that in Fastboot, the model is like you have a literal browser running on the server,
yeah,
and you're telling it to render this page.
Yeah.
So, by the way, we could make Fastboot. We could make our Ember app query the database with Fastboot. There are entry points.
Yeah, rendering context or whatever.
Well, we could do that, and you can like give the Fastboot VM like some globals, so we could like give it access to a database.
Nice. Yeah. Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, but that's not how you're supposed to think about it. People have done that, but that's not how you're supposed to. Like, you want to think of it as a black box browser running on the server that's getting URL
visit
and returning HTML.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the very first areas where I would start experimenting with get server side props.
Like a homepage Ember map?
Like, yeah, latest videos? Like, yeah, maybe a page that lists data from an API.
I have a question. I'm like, my wires are getting crossed here. How does it?
I would also want this. Server-side rendering is important to us for SEO, so I would probably pick one of those pages to start with first. And I think that's like a reason why I wouldn't
use it. And if it couldn't be done at build time.
Yes.
Because if it be done at build time, you're CDNifying everything. You don't need SSR for anything.
Right.
Let's say we're in a situation where, for whatever reason, we're making content site, and when our people edit it, like Medium, like let's say we can't rebuild everything. And like when I edit it, it needs to come from a database or whatever. So... but and you want SEO, a server, and yeah, and SEO matters. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So this sounds like a good spot for get server side props.
Okay, let's set aside the SEO and the bots, just for the user. Would you want SSR to fetch the database? No, because you don't want to break the cacheability, like the CDN ability of it, right? Like,
no, I think
you want an even split between what can be done at build time, which is like shell, let's say,
exactly,
and code,
exactly,
and assets, and then you want the client to make a request for like the homepage.
Exactly, because I think,
because like, why make the server do it because of everything we just talked about, basically.
Well, I also think you can put the shell on the CDN,
yeah,
get it to the client faster, yeah, they get something on the screen faster, and then the client can do the request for the data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, there's, by the way, we're being like real abstract here. Mm-hmm. There's probably like tons of real world
cases,
constraints,
where, yeah,
like requirements where we would change this. So like, yeah, maybe we could do our data fetching on the server, on the edge server,
yeah,
and then just cache it
for a certain amount of time,
yeah,
and like implement like a cache bushing thing there, so it's like simpler conceptually.
Right. But again, that's a bunch of work. So it really depends on the requirements here. But I think as a default, kind of what we were saying, like app shell,
yeah,
pre-rendered, and then fetch the data.
Using use effect or using get server-side props?
Use effect.
Yeah, interesting. I'd really like to see, I feel like we need a big matrix and like all the different cases in which API you would use. So like, okay, I'm running the Twitter homepage. It has to be fresh.
I have a use case for
versus get, I'm running our about page. It can be built at it can be generated server side.
I have a use case for get server side props. It's just gonna kind of combine everything we just talked about.
Secrets or something that are at the edge.
Exactly. So, yeah. I have to render this page. It needs to be server side rendered, and the fetch call requires an API key that I don't want to share.
Yeah.
It requires an API key to like my Contentful account.
Right.
and it's like a private key. So I can put that in, I can put that in get server side props and guarantee that like that code is only going to be run in one spot, secure spot.
Right.
It's funny how there's like security for me, which is on the server, and there's security for you, which is in the browser. So it's really easy to tangle all these terms as we're discussing them.
But there are security benefits for different reasons in both environments. There's still reasons. What you're saying now doesn't invalidate our discussion earlier.
100%.
Yeah.
But yeah, that might be the case. And yeah, like maybe I need to make database calls to get this data.
Yeah.
And I want to do server-side rendering.
Even though, again, the database could be at the edge in a sense that it doesn't have to go back to...
Right, but I don't want my clients accessing the database. Sure. So that could be a place for get server-side props.
Right. Interesting. Interesting.
I think it's really cool. Really cool that you have all these hooks and you can make this. And I think as we would be building an app, we could look at all of our requirements and start circling things.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Like homepage. Yeah. A video page is shared on Twitter. We need a media card. All right. We need to introduce some server side rendering.
And we have a way to talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when we went to Fastboot, we didn't.
It was too black box.
We had to. We just developed that language over time.
Yep. With a caching layer and everything. Also, like what can be CDNified. So right now we have a caching layer in our server that we can bust.
Yep.
That Rails, it lives in Node. Our Rails server has all of our data and lets us update videos. And when we update a video, the Rails server handles that request, responds, and then also sends a message to the Node server that says, if you have a cache with a key that includes video 123, it's now invalid.
Yeah, it sends out a message. It just says video 123 changed.
Gotcha. So now the Node server can say whatever. It can do whatever. But what it does. Like,
screw you, Rails. I use asynchronous IO.
I live in front of you, so I say it's still valid. Yeah. So now that basically like evicts that, and so any request that comes through for like video 123, or like if the homepage includes video 123, the next request that comes through for that is going to bypass that and like go to like origin, let's say. But just thinking about deploys, our node is our, let's say, do we deploy in multiple places right now? Our server?
Yeah. We deploy to multiple
regions.
No, we deploy everything.
We have our Rails and Node running in one place.
They're running on two different servers.
But in one.
In one spot in the physical world.
There are two of them. There's one of each. There's only one of each of them.
Yeah, there's, you know, their load balance. There's like four of them.
Yeah, but in the same room.
Yeah, yes.
In Bill's basement or something. So if we wanted to take advantage of... Correct me if I'm wrong. With Next.js, you like literally can you can put your servers. You can like in the same way that CDN is like exists in all these places around the world. Correct, your servers can as well.
Yep.
And so if we did that, would our architecture be ready for that or no? Because
our architecture would be ready. There's some shortcuts we've taken, which is it's not essential complexity. It's just a byproduct of shortcuts.
But the Node server doesn't need to be talking to the database.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the thing. What makes it replicatable.
Right.
Whereas the Rails server doesn't.
So right. So we would always only have one Rails server, but we could put Node servers all over the world. And then when a Rails thing changes, Rails doesn't talk. It just puts a message out into the ether. I've changed.
Video 123.
Video 123.
And any Node server can
respond to it. And we actually don't care if like one respond, if one Node server like handles that right away and clears its cache. And another Node server maybe takes like 30 seconds.
Right, that's fine.
That's fine with us. Right. Yeah.
Right, interesting.
So we could...
Which is better than like having... The reason going to the database every time in origin is bad because it's like way slower. This still has to go to origin, which is a Rails server, to like get the latest messages, but like you're able to like abstract what part is like can be cached and what part needs to change and everything.
Yeah.
And in this particular case, the way we have the Node servers, they could go anywhere.
Yeah. Yes.
And
now that's not like just to be clear here, we make some assumptions. Like, we're always running on Heroku. And so we rely on some, yeah. Heroku provides a bunch of build information, and we use that.
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't just switch to Next
because we have some. Yeah, throw up our node code.
Now, we could refactor that. Right, there's right. nothing like,
there's nothing essential. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not essential to the architecture. It's incidental to just our setup. Yeah.
Question. So, like, when we evict the cache in node, it's, like, super fast, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but let's say you took node out of the picture and you just, like, use CDNs with, like, pages, which I guess is, like, SSG, I guess. But
now you have to pay that 8-minute cost every time you change something, which might be fine.
Because you need to... But why not...
You have to build... rebuild the app.
But why not just do what we do now, but instead of putting the cached value into node, you, like, create a file with that HTML response that was generated and upload it to a CDN.
Yeah, that's like what Gatsby, that's how we deploy a Gatsby app, right? We build an HTML file and upload it to a CDN.
We can do it on a per request basis as opposed to having to rebuild the whole app, just like we do today. So let's say, let's say the node server is what can actually build a response on a per request basis, right? It's running fastboot. So let's say you have fastboot at origin, one node server instead of n.
Yep.
You have one near Rails, and then first hit comes in, it's cold, so it gets a client shell, and then the client does everything. Meanwhile, we kick off a job where, like, fastboot's, like, rendering it or whatever. Now, instead of putting that in a node caching layer, you, like,
yeah, you put it on S3. And then you tell CloudFront.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, you can do that. I think
how long does it take to invalidate the next time you want to do that?
So you need to make sure you're using a CDN that offers, like, instant invalidation. I know Fastly does. Fastly's model is that it goes back to origin when a file is missing from the CDN. So there's
So the Rails message would have to, like, tell Fastly this thing is wrong. Like, this thing is invalid now.
And then
Fastly would make it so it talks to origin, which hits the fastboot instance to get the new page.
Yep, exactly.
And then you wouldn't have to worry about deploying node servers. You would just let the CDN take care of replication.
Your Fastly instance is your end node. Yeah. Your Fastly instances are your end node servers. But there's complication here because, like, we need to run code at the edge.
What code? Like the secret
stuff? Hold on. So we would have one fastboot thing.
Yeah, at origin.
At origin.
Yeah. I'm trying to understand if this is different.
No. We could totally do this. Yeah, we could totally.
And then we're not responsible for, like, the edge servers anymore. We just are responsible for origin, basically.
Yes.
Like, we're not responsible for it.
Yes. Yep. And we already have a way.
What about the buckets that we do with, like, the user session? Can you do that with Fastly?
Yeah. So I actually looked into this when we started this, and Fastly has Varnish, and Varnish has a whole programming language called VCL, and you can say when a request comes in, this is how I get the cached version. So I can write code that's like a request comes in,
redirects.
It's not even intercepts. It's just when a request comes in, I do these things, so I can, like, check the user.
Mm.
I can see all this, and then I get this. And then I get this. This is my cache thing. So I could have, like, three buckets. And I could say, okay, well, if the user is an admin, this is their cache response. If the user is a paid subscriber, this is their cache response. And I can, like, literally run that code in Fastly on the edge.
Oh, my gosh.
But, like, VCLs. So this is why I didn't do this. VCLs is just a whole programming language.
It's like VimScript.
It's a whole programming language. I like frameworks in the sense that, like, frameworks are made, like, I can pull them down on my computer, I can write test suites, I can share the code with you, like, this was like
I'm never ever gonna look at this file. You could print it out.
File, here's a text area, paste your VCL code in here.
You could print that out. Siri, Shut up. You could print that out and shove it in my face, and I'm going to see something that looks like VimScript or Bash or VCL, and I'm going to say, get that out of my, get that out of here.
So that's why I didn't go with that. Also, too, it's like, just needing to run Node anyway for Fastboot.
Yeah.
Node is a good place to do all this caching stuff.
I see.
We're running code anyway, why not?
But we're not taking advantage of our caching layer is not being currently distributed globally.
Correct.
Whereas our assets are, because we just flipped a switch.
Yep.
And that is
something like that would be the next evolution. Where
that would be
like,
maybe the next lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Would be to get the, we already have the cache response.
I mean, if Heroku makes it so easy to deploy.
Already, yeah.
And I got to imagine that all these other services, at some level, they know they're competing with Heroku, even though they offer the edge deployments.
Yeah.
Like, are just Netlify. Netlify makes it super easy to deploy.
Yeah.
So yes. I'm not, if we had to do this,
yeah,
I think we'd be able to.
It's also very cool that we already have the hard part, which is like being able to regenerate the HTML for /video/123 without rebuilding the entire app.
Yes.
So it's not like we have to do the Gatsby thing where we pay the whole price and redeploy a whole thing, because Fastboot is like really like a service to like,
yeah,
it's really like a service.
It is. That's back to the black box thing. Yeah,
yeah.
It's a service. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, maybe that's a nice in between where goes back to my original question, which is like, right now we have one node caching layer server at origin, and as soon as video 123 changes, we evict it. So the next time someone makes a request, it's almost like you'll basically never see stale data on Ember Map, because they'll hit they'll have a cache miss, they'll get the full Ember app, which will then make the data request to origin.
Yep.
So you might have a slow response because you won't hit that. But if you care about never showing stale data, you can do that. So my question here is, go ahead.
I was gonna say, there is a stale data scenario where like you make the change in Rails and
the message is in flight while someone hits the cache. But the time between the change event from Rails happening at origin to get to node at origin and evict the cache is really small compared to, which was my question, how fast is like Fastly? If you're using Fastly and it has pushed out the version of the page to the edge and then you send a message to it, how long does it take to tell it to evict and how long does it actually take to evict?
So Fastly might not be a good example for this case, because their whole value add
is that we are a CDN that does fast.
Is instant. Yeah,
okay. So maybe, okay.
But like, let's pick on someone like AWS.
Yeah,
CloudFront is not made for this.
Mm-hmm.
And when we used to deploy our Ember app that didn't have a backend, we were just doing everything in Mirage. We were mm-hmm. deploying it from AWS,
mm-hmm.
and the eviction times could be 20 plus minutes.
Got you.
A lot of times it was like, I noticed that I think what was happening, it would evict from like 90% of edges in like a minute, and then there would be a couple that lagged
mm-hmm.
and would take 15 minutes for you to confirm the eviction.
I see.
But again, they're not made for that sort of thing.
I have a question. Isn't like cache invalidation one of the two hardest problems in computer science? What does Fastly do to solve this?
Well, no. It's the same problem that I brought up, that I was like being pedantic, but it's the same problem. You could make a change in Rails and the eviction message is in flight and you are viewing stale data.
Yeah.
And if you need like, I mean,
it's fast, but
like it could be 50 milliseconds.
Yeah.
And
but if it's effectively as fast as it would be for our case, it seems like a pretty good architecture, because you have the best of both worlds. You're serving what you can from a CDN. And also your rebuild time is like, you're not paying a rebuild time. You're just paying a regeneration time. It's like a service that regenerates the particular page that was evicted based on what data was changed. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You're not we have 200 videos on Ember Map. You change one, you really need to change maybe the homepage and that video and that series page. And like, that's 3 out of whatever, 1,000 pages or whatever, something like that.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that turns us off of
like Gatsby for
SSG or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. SSG for all of Ember Map. That would be crappy, because like, I want to be able to edit the thing and just see the change. I like that. I edit it and I just go back to the site and it's there.
Yep. It's fast.
I like that. I think that's like something we shouldn't give up from like Rails era apps. You know what I'm saying?
I know. I'm just laughing because like the fact that like doing a CRUD operation and then not seeing it on the page is like actually something that's
that
like,
a lot of people deal with. Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. But
it's funny that that's like something that's like on the table as a trade-off that we can give up.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I guess that is the trade-off, that it's super fast. But like, how hard was it to build this thing with the messaging and the keys that we did? I mean,
I didn't
build any of that. We talked about it. We together.
I
like to think I contributed something.
No, dude, come on, you did.
Just kidding. We arrived at this idea. It's nice. You have the models and you have the cache keys based on the models needed to generate the page, which Ember Data made really nice for us.
JSON API.
JSON API made super nice.
Because everything has a type and
identity.
An ID.
You tie it to identity. Yep. Yeah.
And so if we're looking at post one include comments, we know that if post one changes or if any comment changes,
right?
Any comment, not just the post comments, we know to invalidate.
Right.
So I would say that the hardest part of this, it took about a year, which sounds like a long time. It wasn't full time over the year. Getting the terminology down and actually thinking about all this stuff was the hardest part, where I think if I had to like re-implement this from scratch, it would go pretty quickly because we know how to talk about it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I
was going to say we should get working on the edge just to like close that.
No, it's like gap. It feels like a low hanging fruit based on all the work we've already done.
Yep. Again, we rely on Heroku.
Yeah.
I love Heroku. It's so easy to deploy to Heroku.
Yeah.
If Heroku had multi zone deployment, multi data center deployment,
we would just pay for that.
We would just drag that slider all the way to the top and push that button.
Right, because they're two separate Heroku apps, so they don't have to worry about like the database being like out of all that stuff. Yeah. We'd just do it for the Node app and then it would be it.
Yep. So that's the caveat silly blocker for this. Do we really want to invest time here?
I have to run, but I guess the last thing really quick with like Rail, I guess the other side of this is like the Rails side, where like every request is generated from server side calls dynamically, and then you start to cache pieces using like the Rails caching APIs.
Russian doll.
Yeah. Can that be CDN'd and everything, right?
No, that doesn't get CDN.
How does that cache in the memory of the Rails server?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So how would you get that into a CDN? There's no good way. That's not the happy path there.
You don't.
Like now and next are thinking about it from different side.
You don't, because Rails talks to a database, and typically these databases have constraints where they can only live in one area.
Yeah.
And so even if you're running Rails apps on the edge, if they have to talk to a database in Virginia, you kind of lose some of that edge. If the edge always has to talk to Virginia, then you can no longer just get a HTML
if you avoid the database call because of the caching layer. The problem is you've already gone to Virginia.
If you could avoid the database call, then Rails doesn't make a database query and doesn't need to go back to Virginia. But the way
because the Rails server is running on
the edge. But we don't really think about Rails apps like that. Like every Rails app takes the session cookie and loads a current user, right? We all do that. We all have like a before action.
Yeah.
Before action or application.
How does it know like model one has changed?
Great question, because let's just invalidate everything I just said. It uses a timestamp of the model. So it always runs a database query. Rails caching doesn't improve the actual
architect. It doesn't change
the time coupling to the database. Yeah, it doesn't change the coupling to the database. Okay. It's just you can wrap some really expensive code. Maybe you do like a Russian doll cache for post one, and then inside that cache, you do a crazy like post.comments.users. Mm-hmm. So Rails can go fetch post one, look at the timestamp. If the timestamp matches a cache, then it doesn't need to run that inner code.
It just gets the HTML.
But if the timestamp is newer, now it can rerun that inner code. So you're still coupled to the database.
Yeah, I see.
Maybe it's less database queries. But yeah, in Rails, people have done edge deployments with Rails. And I think one of the really exciting things here is we're now seeing databases that run on the edge, like actual SQL databases.
Yeah.
So that like
Dynamo? No,
no, no, no, no, no. It would be like CosmoDB, I think, is one from Microsoft. There's Aura from Amazon. They're new. We don't have a lot of experience with them, but like for standard, I think they do standard SQL stuff perfectly fine. So technically, you could run Rails on a bunch of servers all over the world, and it would connect to this database, but
that's fine because the database just takes care of.
Yeah, and it's like a black box. It's like the DNS would get you to the closest instance of your database. You don't have to. You're not going to Virginia every time,
right?
So yeah, I think I actually think like for like Rails developers, this is pretty exciting that you can get these sort of run at the edge things.
Right. So. Pretty interesting stuff, man.
Yeah.
I want to talk more about this. I think next time I'm going to reread this transcript and also the serverless stuff. We can talk about some of that too, because you and me and Adam were having some cool conversation about that. I was drinking the Kool-Aid, man. Drinking it deep. Unhinging my jaw. Just taking it straight, you know?
Everything is rewritten as a Lambda function.
Yep. I'm there, man. I haven't even done it yet, and I'm there. All right. I got to run. I got to get some laundry. Yeah. That was fun. A lot of cool stuff. I'll make sure to get some of those links in there. Thanks for listening. We'll see you after EmberConf.
Bye.